due to easing to the afternoon. Paying attention to the posture. Sitting up straight. Relaxing, softening, having just eaten, paying attention to the feeling of either fullness and feeling pleasurable, feeling of fullness and it being uncomfortable as just a feeling. How do we respond to that feeling? It's a dependent origination. Is not necessarily about a fixed trajectory of events, but how we respond to the different events, different parts of the dependent origination cycle. Feeling is a very important link feeling is in terms of the structure of dependent origination. Feeling is the result of karma, result of past action. So that whatever feeling we are experiencing, the causes have been set, have been put in motion. The next link from feeling is desire. That is present action. That is what will condition our response, will condition future feeling. Just that, say whether one is, when we've had our lunch, whether one is full and feeling pleasant, comfortable, or whether one's eaten and is full and uncomfortable, or is not full and uncomfortable. Didn't quite get enough. The feeling is there, and then how do we respond to it? And paying close attention to how we respond to feeling. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. These are the range, and from a Buddhist perspective, the word we use as feeling is different from the range of emotion that, say, that can be used in the English word of feeling. That is sort of covered by another set of terms and terminology. The word feeling, as we use it, is a specific term referring to pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, neutral feeling, the kind of very root basic feeling response. So paying attention to feeling. If we follow our habit and general pattern of the human realm, pleasant feeling has this sort of the seeds of desire, or the possibility of desire within it, in terms of that. On statistical average, that's usually where the mind goes. Unpleasant feeling tends to bring up the tendency to aversion. Neutral feeling has the tendency to be associated with delusion, or not seeing things clearly, moha. Not seeing things clearly. So that, you know, if one pays attention and just sort of sees that predilection, and by applying awareness, attention, we can we recognize that we don't have to respond in that way. We can respond in any number of ways because we have awareness and discernment. Then we can make our own choice rather than just follow conditioning, our own conditioning or the conditioning of the world around us or societal conditioning. We can make choices. We can exercise our freedom. It takes an attentiveness to feeling. So that in our meditation, observing breath, observing the body, the posture, so when things are pleasant, what happens to our posture? There's a feeling of pleasantness. Do we let things slump, or do we how do we react in this unpleasant feeling, pain, discomfort? You know, what does our body feel like? Can we relax it? Can we not follow the tendency to dwell in aversion? When there's a neutral feeling, not so pleasant, not unpleasant, can we still exercise attention, mindfulness? So much of our as we become more seasoned meditators, have more experience. The extremes aren't so, they don't bother us so much. there's a neutral feeling that's coming up more. And it's kind of pleasant, kind of calm. But is there actually mindfulness? Is there attention? Is there a clarity of mind, of heart there? This is a conditioning factor, a conditioning sense. So that to pay attention to posture, pay attention to the breath. Observe the rhythm of the breathing. Recognize feelings as a conditioning factor. Part of this process of dependent origination. Where does it take us? How do we deal with it? It takes us time to sit quietly. Discourses of the Buddha, it comes up kind of a stock phrase that obstructed by ignorance and bound by craving is a sort of pointed to as the reason why we on a larger scale, we wander in the cycle of birth and death, and on a smaller scale, why we create sort of emotional suffering and confusion in our lives. So that this dependent origination is a you have these two points where one say contributes to the cycle in terms of either ignorance or craving. And these are sort of two entry points for say confusion or how we create suffering. And if it were just one, it might be a little easier to deal with. But with the two of them working together, it's a definite sort of one-two combination, it creates problems, difficult to disentangle, so that the sense of paying attention. Learning, understanding. Another aspect, though, is that whatever, say, the causes there are that create suffering, say this. Dependent origination cycle, that also is conditioned. That also is dependent. This also dependently arises. When you study in the scriptures and you read, you see this cycle starting from ignorance, because of ignorance there is the volitional impulses, because of volitional impulse. And it starts off at ignorance, and it ends up at suffering. And it's easy to sort of think that sort of this ignorance is a sort of like the original cause, and that there always was ignorance. Ignorance is this immutable sort of the unconditioned reality of existence. But there are discourses where the Buddha points to the fact that ignorance has its conditions. It has ignorance is dependently arisen, and therefore is can be dealt with. So that in a sense, what are the causes and conditions for ignorance? And also, good to sort of point out what is, when we say ignorance in English, what is the Pali word? The Pali word is avijja. And vijja is knowledge. Avijja is non-knowledge, lack of knowledge. When we say ignorance, we're saying the lack of knowledge of the true nature of things. Lack of true understanding. And that's also interesting I imagine most people here, if you've been practicing for a while, maybe had some cross-lineage exposure to different teachings. And in Tibetan tradition, the Vajrayana tradition, there's the term Rigpa, which is your foundational awareness, your sort of your awakened state of mind. And what Rigpa is in Sanskrit is vicha. So there you go. We have the same Buddha. So when the Buddha points to what are the conditioning factors of avijja, of ignorance, he points to the five hindrances, it's like whenever you'd go to do a meditation course, 10-day course or something like that, you'll probably get a talk on the five hindrances first or second day. These are the hindrances to say meditation or to concentration. But they're also on a deeper level, and they definitely are the hindrances to meditation, concentration, but on a much deeper level, this conditioning process is supporting ignorance, is supporting avijja, supporting lack of knowledge. So that when you look at it, there's five hindrances: sensual desire, aversion, drowsiness, sloth and torpor, restlessness, worry, and then doubt. Those are things that I've been working with. Those are things that I can deal with. It's within one's realm to be able to deal with that. So cracking the nut of ignorance doesn't seem so impossible. There's also discourses where the Buddha points to other conditioning factors of and supporting conditions for avijja are what are called the asavas. They're the underlying outflows. Literally it means outflows, so that that movement of mind which does not see reality, does not see truth, moves toward something. And it moves toward sensuality, it moves toward becoming. It moves towards views and opinions. And it moves towards, and there's avijja, not seeing suffering, not seeing that there's freedom from suffering. So one sees that there is this conditioning process, and it's certainly things that we're familiar with. We know what it feels like when we have opinions and views. We know what it feels like when we're trying to prop up our sense of self, starting to the kind of dis-ease, worry, elation that comes when we're praised, and then the niggling sort of worries and concerns that maybe I'm not actually worth it. The sense of self, being, becoming, trying to support these conditions. So these are the conditions, the causes, and they also, say, these are just conditions. They're just they're only that much. This is something that Ajahn Chah would emphasize in his teaching, in training us, so this seeing things as, say, just that much, or just only that much. It's it's no big deal. The fact that we say we have a view, or we have a desire, or we have whatever, or it's just that much. It's only, we don't have to act on it. We don't have to believe in it. We don't have to beat ourselves up for it. It's just that much. And when we see it as just that much, then we don't have to feed it. And when we don't feed things, they cease to have nutriment. They cease to have support for their existence. And Ajahn Chah used to really encourage us to, in terms of the in terms of practice. What you're doing is creating a container or a sphere of attention with which one can observe one's life, one's mind, one's heart, one's what one's experiencing, and these the container. It's the container of awareness, container of mindfulness, container of discernment, investigation, mindfulness and wisdom, to be able to contain or encompass whatever one is experiencing with mindfulness and wisdom. Drawing it around, not in terms of know, in the sense of containing it so that one can squash it and annihilate it. But so that one can observe it, understand it, learn from it, and not be affected by it. I remember him one time sitting and encouraging us in practice and saying, where, you know, when you first, when you're doing this containing the heart, the mind with all its conflicting impulses and emotions and feelings, and so it's like putting a tiger from the forest and putting it in a cage. And the reaction that the mind has, and this, and it roars and it paces and it bats away at the bars. And what you need to do is this trusting in having built a sturdy cage of mindfulness and wisdom. You can watch, you can observe. You don't have to be fighting. You don't have to go in and fight with the tiger. You don't have to go subdue this tiger. You really need to have made that cage really well, develop those conditions of mindfulness and wisdom. And you know, after a while, that tiger will start to tire out. And after being tired for a little while, it'll get up and it'll roar and it'll pace and it'll bat away at the cage. And but again, sort of the cage of the container of mindfulness, the container of wisdom, is strong. And, you know, after it roars, and it, after a while, lies down. And, you know, and after some time, you know, all it can do is just this, meow, meow. So this, paying attention to the container, and having the confidence that, you know, these arise through conditions. The desire is not sort of the ultimate nature of our being. Ignorance is not sort of an ultimate reality. These are conditioned phenomena. We have to learn, we have to understand, we have to see clearly. By doing that, we are able to truly experience an abiding in peace. And peace doesn't necessarily mean that one isn't experiencing that which is painful or that which is difficult. But being able to see it from a vantage point of mindfulness or wisdom. Yeah. And even if one has some insight and wisdom and knowledge, and still it isn't as if as Westerners, we tend to our view is sort of that, once we go enlightened, get enlightened, then we won't have anything, we won't have to deal with this stuff. And that's not really the way it is. the stuff is there. And I remember he was the manager of the Insight Meditation Society, IMS, in Barre, Massachusetts, the year that Ajahn Chah gave a 10-day retreat there. And he said one of the things that struck him the most about Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Chah was there, and Ajahn Chah can be extraordinarily, could be, he's dead now, he could be extraordinarily charming and charismatic and exude extreme warmth and he was doing that. He was really he was really drawing people in, and then toward the end of the retreat, he had been sort of dazzling people with his presence. And after a talk that he gave, he got up and started to walk out, and he was walking quite slowly, and he stopped in the middle of the hall with the people around him, and he stopped and looked at everybody and said, "My knees hurt." Bodies get old. Everybody's like this. And then he kept walking. He said that was one of the things, of all the sort of dazzling things that Ajahn Chah had said during that retreat, said that really stuck with him. That really stuck with him. That, somebody, and that was how this person interpreted it, sort of that, for however enlightened you may think that I am, I also experience old age, sickness, death, pain, difficulties, and whatnot. So it was, everybody has to experience this. So this is what dependent origination is for. How do we experience it? What choices are we putting in? Go to my notes. There's a very poignant utterance which the Buddha gave, and it's in the Majjhima Nikaya, where the middle length sayings, where he's relating his experience of his enlightenment, and he says, "Now while the Blessed One was alone in retreat," and this is just after his enlightenment, "this thought arose in him. This Dhamma that I have attained to is profound and hard to see, hard to discover. It is the most peaceful and superior goal of all, not attainable by mere ratiocination, thinking, mere thinking, subtle for the wise to experience. But this generation relies on attachment, relishes attachment, delights in attachment. It is hard for such a generation to see this truth, that is to say, specific conditionality, dependent arising. And it is hard to see this truth, That is to say, stilling of all formations, relinquishing of the essentials of existence, exhaustion of craving, fading of lust, cessation, nibbana. And if I taught the Dhamma, others would not understand me, and that would be wearying and troublesome for me. Those were one of the Buddha's first thoughts. I don't think anybody's going to get this. But that's also where, say, in the history of the mythology of the Buddha, where the Brahma Sahampati cognizes this thought of the Buddha and comes down, appears before him, and that's his sort of thought. Is, oh, the world is lost. The world is lost. The awakened one doesn't incline to teach him, and he comes down and encourages the Buddha, saying that that there are many different temperaments and personalities and types, and the comparison of the lotus flowers. Some are stuck in the mud, but there's others that do really rise up above the water. And there are beings with little dust in their eyes. And invites the Buddha to teach. And the Buddha does do it. So he reviews that, reflects on that, considers it, and says, yes, this is true. There are beings who can discern this truth. So he inclines to teach him. And it's interesting when the Buddha does decide to teach, what he chooses as his first teaching, his entry into the Dhamma. Because the first teaching is on the Four Noble Truths, and this is a way of encapsulating this truth, not just encapsulating the truth, but also giving a way of working with it, practicing with it, so that. And the Buddha spent a certain amount of time under the Bodhi tree, around the Bodhi tree, delighting in the bliss of deliverance. And when he does decide to teach, he reflects and considers who is capable of understanding, and he decides that the five ascetics who had practiced with him would be suitable. Would be right. Their faculties would be right enough for them to understand. And so that this teaching on the Four Noble Truths is one that's coming from a fully enlightened being who has had the opportunity to spend his time reviewing his enlightenment and reflecting on what would be most useful, what would work. And then he was enlightened in Bodh Gaya, and then he went to the deer park outside of Benares, Sarnath, to teach. And it's about 3-4 weeks walking so that the Buddha had time to consider, right? And he didn't just sort of leap up from underneath the Bodhi tree and then go out and sort of, you know, bash people with his enlightened knowledge. He really took, you know, there was time to consider and really reflect, and this, you know, this is a mind that's fully open. And through his whole 45 years of teaching, that was just kept coming up over and over again. This was the theme, the doorway into really seeing and practicing. So that, you know, these Four Noble Truths, the dependent origination is a kind of extrapolation or an expansion on the Four Noble Truths, but they're also like a doorway into being able to understand these Four Noble Truths more clearly. And you know, the Four Noble Truths are, they cover the whole range of however the, you know, however the mind moves and we create suffering, whether it's on the realm of desire or on the realm of say views and being, which is something that other traditions sort of bash the Theravadins for. It's like, you know, the Four Noble Truths are just sort of rinky-dink sort of stuff, and then the real stuff comes after. It's not really, it's really a, you know, a perfect doorway into both practicing and how to view things and to clarify. When the after the Buddha taught, and the first five disciples, his name was Asaji, was after the first rains, the Buddha taught the first five disciples at the beginning of the rains retreat, and then during the rains retreat they stayed in the Deer Park in Benares, and various people started drawing around the Buddha. And by the end of that rainy season, there were 80 enlightened beings who had taken ordination, and the Buddha advised everybody to go off wandering, and then he was going to go back to an area near Bodh Gaya, actually, to teach as well. So they, and during this time when these first 80 disciples were off wandering, then Asaji, who was one of the first five, was wandering for alms in the village, and Sariputta was a wanderer in another sect, and a religious seeker, and he saw Asaji, and just seeing the demeanor of him going, he was going for alms round, and just seeing his demeanor and the kind of aura, the feeling that was created, the thought came into Sariputta's mind that either this is a fully enlightened Buddha, or he's got to be a disciple of a fully enlightened Buddha. There is something very different about this person. And he waited for him to finish his alms round, and then approached him to ask questions on, ask him to query on Dhamma. and ask what his practice was, who his teacher was. And when Asaji was asked by Sariputta, what was his, what kind of teaching did he follow? Then Asaji said, "I'm newly ordained. I can't really explain it that well." And Sariputta says, "Well, I don't want to. You don't have to be extensive. You don't have to talk a lot. You can just sort of give me a hint. give me a little bit." And then Asaji says to Sariputta, the perfect one has told the cause of causally arisen things and what brings their cessation too. Such is the doctrine preached by the great monk. And on hearing that, Sariputta is attains stream entry. He gets it very quickly. So that was Sariputra's entry into the Dhamma, and the conviction that he would follow Asaji's teacher. And it's also, but Sariputta and Moggallana were friends, and they practiced together under the same teacher. And when Sariputta was enlightened, they had a pact between them, and they probably practiced together. They probably wandered and sought other teachers at different times, but they had a pact between the two of them that whoever finds the Dhamma first, or finds the deathless first, would have to go back and tell the other one. So that was Sariputta's thought. Would go, okay, I got something to tell them all around. and he goes back and Moggallana looks at him and says, "Your faculties are bright, friend. you look calm." And he says, "I certainly am." And then he's, what have you heard? And he's, quote, he does the same quote: "The perfect one is told the cause of causing the arisen things, and what brings their cessation to. Such is the doctrine preached by the great monk." And then Moggallana is attains the entry into the stream of Dhamma. And the both of them, so they decide, okay, we're going to practice with the Buddha. And they're getting ready to go, and then they think of their teacher who they've been practicing under, Sanchaya Balitaputta, and their teacher was under the classification of a radical skeptic, how it's put. So that anyway, they go and tell the Sanjaya, "Wow, we've heard this teaching, and there's this great teacher, and why don't you come and practice under this great teacher also. We are going to go and practice and live under this teacher. We want to ordain with him. We want to train under him." And Sanjaya says, no. And they're sort of questioning him, and why not? And I've been a teacher already. I don't want to be a disciple of anybody's. And then they sort of, well, he's obviously this is really great wisdom and stuff. And then Sanjaya uses a logical argument he said, you know, what is there more of in the world? Are there more wise people and intelligent people, or are there more fools? I said, well, there's more fools. I said, well, then I'll teach the fools, and I'll let the those intelligent people go to the Buddha. Certain element of avijja functioning there. Avijja. So that story of Asaji, when I was training with Ajahn Chah, it's a story which Ajahn Chah would relate and use as a teaching story over and over. One for the kind of entry into cause and effect and dependent origination, but from Ajahn Chah's use as a teaching story, in terms of instructing us as monks. He used it a lot because he was saying that the importance of one's conduct and one's demeanor, how one lived, was Asaji. You know, Sariputta was not attracted to Asaji because of Asaji sort of out there expounding or extemporizing on philosophy in any astute way, but he was composed, he was peaceful, he was centered, he was there. Something was very present. So that in terms of our own practice and how we live, the effect that we have in the world. By really adhering to Dhamma, living this practice of Dhamma, we affect the world around us. And it's very important this is also dependently arisen. There are causes and conditions. This is the way it is in the way things are in the world. When there is some calm or some centeredness, something happens. And I'm reminded of a story that has always stuck in my mind, of a person who was living in Japan and studying Aikido. And Aikido is a martial art, but it's very much its emphasis is non-violent and non-aggressive, so that it's very defensive. And basically sort of moving energy, deflecting energy, moving energy through, so that one isn't sort of bashing up against something. It's not an aggressive martial art. And this is, on a certain level, this is, you know, in terms of how we deal with defilements, or how we deal with difficulties, or how we deal with practice. This is another sort of paradigm of rather than, you know, getting in there and bashing away the defilements, how do we sidestep them? How do we see them clearly so that they're moved through us or around us? This person who was living in Japan and been doing very hard training for quite a long time with Aikido, and he's American as well, and he hadn't really got the opportunity to really beat up anybody, to really test his skills, could really defeat somebody, because you're not supposed to do that. He was riding a train out in the countryside and training, and this is back in the 50s, maybe late 50s, things weren't quite so modern. And he was sitting on this train, and then there's a stop, and people start getting on, and so who gets on is this drunken, obviously a drunken, sort of like laborer, big, burly guy, very drunk, very dirty, very abusive, and is, you know, very loud and violent, and he's cursing at people, and he takes a swat at this woman and his little and her little child, and people are sort of trying to get out of his way. And what clicks through his mind, right, boy, I can really get up, I'm going to cream this guy, and I've got my chance, this is surely the right opportunity for me to use my what I've learned. The cowboy movies and riding into town and what, cleaning up the forces of good over the forces of evil. This is a righteous cause. So he stands up, and he knows he can't sort of go in and start something, so he just stands up to make himself known and seen. And then this drunken guy sort of says, "Is this Westerner?" And he makes some abusive comment to him. This Westerner needs some lesson in Japanese manners, obviously. He doesn't do anything yet. And then, of course, the Westerner just to sort of put an edge to it, sort of blows him a kiss. Just turn up the volume a little bit, see what happens. And then this guy starts to come forward, and they're just sort of getting close. And then there's this sharp little sound, sort of, "Hey!" A little tinkly sound, and both of them look, and it's this little old man probably in his late 70s, still in kimono, old traditional Japanese, and I said, "Hey, what, this lovely sort of building, what you doing?" And they're sort of, he's not quite sure how to deal with it, and then he said, "Hey, have you been, you know, been drinking? Hey, what you been drinking? You've been drinking sake, okay?" And then he starts engaging him in conversation, and this lovely sort of lilting voice, and the Westerners, and he's. The Westerners sort of looking at him and says, "If this guy moves, I'm going to drop him in his socks." But there, but it's sort of changed, it's shifted, me and my wife, we like drinking sake also. You know, every night we sit out in our garden and we heat up our glasses of sake and sit out under and watch our persimmon tree. So you know this. This year the persimmons are really not so good. He said it was a very hard winter last year. And this and talking and I said, "I'll bet you like persimmon trees." I said, and he's got sort of trying to follow it. I said, "Yeah, I like persimmon trees." And he said, "Yeah, I bet your wife likes them too." And this sort of you could see him sort of soften and his hands unclench. "I don't got no wife. My wife died." And "Oh, man, I'll bet your wife, I'll bet your roots." "I'm so sad. And I lost my job. And I don't know what to do." And he sort of sits down beside him. And this little old man sort of stroking him. "Ah, there. No, and then this Westerner, who was, you know, the great defender of all righteousness and good, and sort of blown away, and sort of the train stopped at the next stop, and he just walked off. So there was a lesson, you know, in Aikido. There was a lesson in how you deal with things is, you know, much more important than the ideas you have about it, the theory that you come from it, the kind of right. Because you know, in practice, the kind of, you know, it feels right to, you know, like say, you know, annihilate our defilements and destroy our attachments. But you know, are we really seeing it clearly? Are we really dealing with it in a way that's really according to the way things truly are, with knowledge, with vicha, with a heart that is not sweat and say is not fettered by hindered by ignorance and obstructed by ignorance and bound by craving. You know, that sort of theme to really sort of investigate. You know, how do we do that? And the dynamic that comes from that, very, very different. Very, very different. So that seeing dependent origination, seeing things, how they arise, how they cease. And bringing a different presence to things. You know, in the same way that Asaji brought a very different presence to the world that he lived in, his present moment and how he contacted the world, so that he was able to draw in Sariputta Moggallana. So that ourselves, you know, because this is sort of, you know, one of the themes of personal and social implications of dependent origination. You know, how do we, you know, rather than, you know, some theoretical idea of what society, what quality of being do we bring into the present moment? And that those implications, major implications, big stuff. I think I'll leave that there for right now. The why don't we take a little bit of a stretch, about 15 minutes, a bit of a stretch, either do some stretching in here, go out and do a bit of a walk, or whatever. And try not to engage, try to internalize the reflections and the sustaining the awareness. And we'll come back at 3 o'clock. Quietly. Fostering a mindfulness, wisdom. Quality of knowing. Quality of knowing clearly. This is sort of the central key element of Buddhist practice, and also what the Buddha himself embodied. There's a discourse where Ananda was recounting the great qualities of the Buddha, and the Buddha adds to it. So there's a sort of exchange between the Buddha and Ananda, saying, "That being so, Ananda, remember also this as a wonderful and marvelous quality of a perfect one. A perfect one's feelings of pleasure, pain, or equanimity are known to him as they arise, known to him as they are present, and known to him as they subside. His perceptions are known to him as they arise, known to him as they are present, and known to him as they subside. His thoughts are known to him as they arise, known to him as they are present, and known to him as they subside. And that also I remember, Lord, as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One." That is what the Venerable Ananda said. The Master approved. The bhikkhus were satisfied and they delighted in their Venerable